Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about TechTent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Welcome to TechTent, your weekly guide to all the hottest news from the technology world. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and this week we'll be hearing how Silicon Valley is agonising over whether it is right to cut anyone off from the internet, even white supremacists. We'll also have a lot of data in this programme. We hear about plans for the world's biggest data centre and a project to use data science to make public transport work better. Joining me this week is BBC technology reporter Chris Baranyuk. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Rory.
Good to have you here. And my special guest is a real expert on all things data, Jenny Tennyson, Chief Executive of the Open Data Institute here in the UK. Welcome, Jenny.
Thanks very much.
You're going to be a lot of use to us as we rampage through all things data in the programme. Here's a taste of what's coming up.
Let's say I decide to go to Antarctica where I have ultimate cooling year-round. I still couldn't get the power there.
It's saying the best route is take a tram and then the 101 bus, but that's going to take me 25 minutes. There is another option which will take just 6 minutes, and I'm in a real hurry, so I'm going to grab a cab. More of that in a bit, but first this week, an agonising ethical dilemma for Silicon Valley tech firms. If there is one principle they all stand behind, it is that everyone should have equal access to the internet. None of the firms which act as gatekeepers should be allowed to kick anyone off it. But this week, following the events in Charlottesville, a number of tech firms have acted to try to take the Daily Stormer, a white supremacist Nazi site, offline. Our reporter in Silicon Valley, Dave Lee, has been following that story. Dave, take us through the chain of events.
Yes, so Rory, this is a website that people simply didn't want on the internet anymore, but the way in which it's been removed has got a few people concerned. So after it posted a horrid article about the victim of the attack in Charlottesville, the Daily Stormer was being looked at by people saying, how is it possible that this website is able to be on the internet? And so first pressure was put on GoDaddy, which is a site that sells internet domain names, saying, how can you possibly give your business to this website? And so GoDaddy told the Daily Stormer that it had 24 hours to find a new provider, which at that point the company moved to Google Domains, but within a couple of hours it was kicked off from there. But the most significant move, I think, was from Cloudflare. Now, Cloudflare is a site that protects websites from cyber attacks, so from being flooded with traffic that will knock them offline. And it had protected the Daily Stormer. But by Wednesday, Cloudflare had said it had enough. It was going to remove its protection from the site as well, which essentially was kicking the Daily Stormer off the internet. Now, I think that was a huge moment for a company that until now had, as a point of principle, never stepped in when there was a political opposition to a website. This is Matthew Prince. He's the Cloudflare chief executive.
I feel really anxious because I feel like we had a very principled position and we just made an exception to that position. And while that's very popular, you know, people on Twitter are saying nice things about me, I really worry about the long term. One of our employees sort of said, hey, is today the day the internet died? And he was kidding, kinda, but you know that really is what I worry about. The internet that I've built a company around and spent the last 20 plus years enjoying, which I see as easily one of the greatest creations of humanity. That was one where any idea could exist. I worry that that's a little less true today, and so quite the opposite of being relieved, I'm a little nervous.
So that's Matthew Prince from Cloudflare. He actually sent an extraordinary memo to his staff in which he admitted that it was an arbitrary decision. He basically woke up in the morning, decided to kick them off the internet. And yeah, he's really worried about it. And Dave, others actually share that concern, don't they? And think that what he did was wrong.
Yeah, so there's a group called the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFF, which of course what Cloudflare were able to do and what the other companies were able to do is dangerous. And the reason being is they're saying this is a layer of the internet that is controlled by a tiny number of companies. They're kind of utilities of the internet. And so the decisions they make essentially decide what can and can't be on the internet. And the EFF and Cloudflare and Matthew Prince agrees with them. The EFF is saying these companies shouldn't have that power. They shouldn't be able to make those decisions. And so what needs to happen is a look at how we deal with this. How do you, you know, have a situation where websites that are spewing this kind of stuff are controlled, but not in a way that essentially stops their freedom to say that, which obviously in America is a big, big deal.
Sure. Dave, thanks very much. Let's bring in Jenny Tennyson, our special guest from the Open Data Institute. I mean, Jenny, you've been operating in this world, you know, Open Data Institute. The whole principle on which people like you operate is that you don't get to decide who gets to say things and who doesn't.
Yeah, that's right. And the excellent piece that Matthew Prince wrote around the dilemma and feeling that it shouldn't be his decision to make, I think that that's the real crux of this. Who gets to decide and how do we decide as a society what content should be available and what content we actually, because it is so terrible, I think it's okay to discriminate against Nazi content. But how do we decide that as a society? How do we decide what is Nazi content, what isn't Nazi content? What kind of governance mechanisms should tech companies that are providing infrastructure, that are providing utilities, have in order to make sure that that's acceptable?
And Chris Baraniuk, others have been following suit, haven't they? Others have been acting against this site.
Yeah, there's all sorts of services that have stopped providing it. I think its email provider turned its back on them and so on. It's become such a high-profile case that where one stands on the Daily Stormer has become something of an image thing. And that's, I think, you know, it's not as if it had never published offensive articles before. It's now become such a public case because of Charlottesville.
Let's move on and let's have a look at some of the week's other big tech stories with Chris. Another twist on online freedom here. The American Department of Justice wants to know who's been visiting a particular website. Why?
Yes. So this it all relates to a company that hosted a website set up to help arrange a protest at President Trump's inauguration in January. The Department of Justice says the planning of this protest resulted in a violent riot that happened on the day of the inauguration. But it's also said that it's a particular customer is the subject of this warrant. That's who they want to get the data from, ultimately. But obviously, getting 1.3 million IP addresses implicates many, many more people than that. So DreamHost, who is the company of concern here, has argued that it shouldn't have to comply with such a, and I quote, highly untargeted demand. The concern being that would harm the privacy of a large number of people.
And an interesting case this week on the question of who can use your data when you put it on social media sites.
That's right. This is all about automated programs or bots noticing that a user has modified their LinkedIn profile, potentially a sign that they are on the lookout for a new job. Now, bots like that have been set up by some businesses so they can find out which of their employees might be about to jump ship, as it were. LinkedIn wanted to stop that happening on its network, but a San Francisco judge has now said there's nothing the site can do to stop third parties monitoring public LinkedIn data.
Jenny Tennyson, a bit of a dilemma. It's open data. If I put my data on LinkedIn, I then have got no control over other people coming and scraping it and using it for other reasons.
Well, I think we have to make a distinction between stuff that is public on the internet and stuff that is open. Stuff that's open, it has got an explicit license around it that says that you can reuse this for any purpose. Whereas stuff that's just public on the internet, you know, the terms and conditions that LinkedIn have over access to its data are a bit more fuzzy and a bit more grey than the clear you can do whatever you like. So I think it comes down to what we as the customers of LinkedIn have an expectation of about the way in which our data can be used. If it's public on the net, maybe we do have that expectation that everybody can use it, but probably not represented in this way.
That's not what the judge seems to think at the moment. One more story, Chris. Making a new mobile phone stand out from the crowd is increasingly difficult, but what trick has Nokia tried to do that?
Well, I think Nokia must think that taking a selfie isn't enough for some people. The smartphone maker's latest device, the Nokia 8, has a 13 megapixel cameras on the front and the back, and it can take a picture of the photographer and someone else at the same time. It also lets you take video of something while recording your reaction simultaneously. It's not the first time that technology has been available, but Nokia says it has now made it significantly easier with their new device to live stream the results straight to Facebook and YouTube.
And here's a confession. I've got that phone in here. I did a little video, which you see on the BBC website, about it. Tried to do a live streaming to Facebook from this program, doing the using the Bothy system, horrible word, camera fell off the tripod and stopped. So there's a cautionary word for you. These it's a bit of a niche service. Jenny Tennyson, do you want to have a Bothy rather than a selfie?
I think it's quite interesting for, you know, if you're monitoring a crowd, if you're monitoring one of these protests we keep seeing, to see your own reaction, what's happening behind you as well as what's in front of you.
Ah, so there's
cool.
There's an enthusiast for that.
Yeah.
You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service with Rory Cathlin-Jones. In a moment, using big data to make sure there's room on the bus. Now, just as textile mills were the visible face of the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century, it is data centres which are the factories of the future, as more and more information is stored in the cloud. This week, a company called Colos unveiled plans for the biggest data centre yet. If they raise the money, they envisage a four-storey building using a gigawatt of power, and it will be built up in the Arctic Circle in the town of Ballangen in Norway. Mark Robinson, Joint Chief Executive of Colos, told me why there was a need for such a giant project.
The Internet of Things is starting to overtake our lives. There's things like Amazon Echo and Google Home that give you a lot of voice control over your household. There's smart light bulbs. All of those either have to be controlled from some central place in the cloud, or they accumulate data, large amounts of data, and all of that has to be stored and processed and managed. Not to mention the fact that institutions all over the world accumulate more and more data, the banks, financial institutions, even governments, and they need to house this data and manage it and store it and process it in new and different ways.
And why, when you were thinking about where to build this, did you happen on Norway?
There were really a couple of reasons. The first one is that power in the region that we're in, Narvik, it's really the lowest power prices in Europe. The other thing is it's all coming from hydroelectric plants or it's coming from wind farms. None of it is based on fossil fuels. The next thing is you can't have a good data center without terrific connectivity. And it just so happens that through the region of Narvik, there are a huge number of fiber bundles coming in. There's also another item, which is it's a naturally cool area. So unlike data centers in most regions of the world, there's about 2 weeks out of the year where it's hot enough to have to use an alternative cooling source. But the rest of the year can really be done with nice, fresh, cool air coming in from the area.
We're seeing, obviously, Amazon Web Services and we're seeing Google making big strides in the whole data business, the cloud computing business. Does that make it difficult for anyone else to be there? They're such big, powerful companies, able presumably to offer such low prices. It's quite a difficult landscape to operate in, isn't it?
Well, I don't really see it that way. My view of this is more than likely those parties and others will probably adopt the data center themselves. A lot of them will want space because they'll want to keep their costs down. Furthermore, the bulk of the market is still not in the hands of the companies you just mentioned. There are still companies out there, lots of companies, that maintain their own data center presences. Some of them are in the cloud, some of them actually host their own servers. And our goal is to be as flexible as we can for all of them.
And where's next? You're already in the Arctic Circle. Are people going to go to ever colder places in the search for ways of cutting down on power consumption?
My sense is you're not going to see people go much further north. At some point, it just it doesn't make sense. But the more important question is that they can't go much further north because it's about available power. So if I decided, for example, to go in the other direction, let's say I decided to go to Antarctica where I have ultimate cooling year-round, I still couldn't get the power there, and I'd have to build substantial facilities just to accommodate that. So we really have sort of optimized the location versus the power and connectivity availability.
That's Mark Robinson of Kolos. So, Jenny Tennyson, it looks like lots more data centres will be needed, and the race will be on, though, to make them more efficient, because they are massively power-hungry, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. And it's good to have a diverse set of data centres, a diverse set of suppliers for both the tin and also the services that go on top of them. And we also need to recognise in future that the processing of data is going to be in sensors, it's going to be in our laptops, it's going to be on our smartphones, not just in those data centres as well. But we just need a mix.
Chris Baraniuk, the science of data centres is a big area, isn't it? Everybody looking at ways of making them have greater capacity, but without using more energy.
That's right. I actually recently, for the BBC News website, wrote a little piece about energy efficiency and this sort of thing. And Google, of course, had looked at using AI for its DeepMind data centres.
Yeah, they managed to use AI to... they claim that they were able to cut data use by something, energy use by something like 15%, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. And they found that the best way to do it was not to, you know, put the cooling equipment on at a high level at certain points, but actually keep it at a relatively low level at a more on a more constant basis, and that overall used less energy.
Plus, move them all to northern Norway. A lot of business is going to be generated there. Well, we heard there that one of the reasons we're going to need more data centres is the growth of the Internet of Things, where all sorts of connected devices are sharing data. One example of how this phenomenon could change the way we live is in organising public transport systems. I've been to the northern English city of Manchester, where an experiment is underway to use data to make the buses and trams which serve the city work a whole lot better.
It's shortly after 9 o'clock. I've arrived at Manchester Piccadilly Station, very busy at this time of morning, and I've got an app out to find my way to my first destination. It's saying the best route is take a tram and then the 101 bus, but that's going to take me 25 minutes. There is another option, which will take just 6 minutes, and I'm in a real hurry, so I'm going to grab a cab.
Nick Christos is the UK head of innovation technology for Cisco. The giant American tech firm is part of a project aiming to use data to make Manchester's transport system more responsive to its users' needs.
Well, the problem is that the schedule of the public transportation doesn't consider sudden crowding. So we believe that we can use data to modify the schedule and even to modify physically where the buses need to go in order to alleviate the problem. So we are monitoring continuously the Wi-Fi access points that we have distributed around the city and the number of devices that they are connected. And you can identify that from the Wi-Fi or even from the Bluetooth. And then that will indicate that we have a surge of crowd in a specific place.
My next appointment is at Transport for Greater Manchester, and this time I've obeyed my public transport app. And I've got on the bus, the 102 bus, and I've been able to do that using my mobile phone.
I'm Simon Warburton, Transport Strategy Director at Transport for Greater Manchester.
Simon, how easy is it to know exactly the transport patterns at the moment?
Well, it's a challenge for us. We work quite often with census data that we collect through our own surveys. But we're conscious that there are a range of institutions around us, whether transport, delivery companies, or whether a wider commercial sector around us, that hold all sorts of information about the shape of the city and people's attitudes to travel around the city. And we want to use that richer data to better design our future plan.
So, tram just arriving on my left. What you're saying is, in the future, you might be able to send that tram to me when I needed it, rather than just from a rigid timetable.
Well, we may well be able to do that, but importantly, we can also help you to understand how full's that next tram that's coming along. Are there other people around you who you may be able to share other forms of travel with, so that we can make sure that the journey around an event doesn't become an inconvenience?
Cecilia Wong is Professor of Spatial Planning at Manchester University. She warns that big data is useful, but has its limits.
The data can be massive, and human brain is limited to how to use the information. That means you need to actually have really good hand, have good people. that understand the transport policy, the transport need, and where the issues are, and then go to analyze and process the data into a usable form. Each case in each city, they need to tailor for their own needs, and it's quite dangerous to buy this off-the-shelf product that some commercial firms sell to the local authority to resolve the problem.
That's Professor Cecilia Wong of the University of Manchester with a cautionary note at the end there. Jenny Tennyson from the Open Data Institute. Give us some more examples of where you're seeing inventive use of data in smart cities, in that kind of project.
One that's come up around the collection of data to help make a better kind of data environment for transport is where Oxford City Council and the University of Oxford's Robotics Institute have used the street cleaners to collect data about like a 3D view of what the streets look like. And again, that's data that can feed into transport. It's data that can be used also to help, you know, create games if you want. To help people to navigate around their city. We are engaged in a project at the Open Data Institute around making data available around what physical activities are available within a particular city. That's the kind of data that you want to make available if you have an obesity problem. You want people to know where they can go for a tennis club or a yoga class or to go swimming. And the other kind of data that I've seen very recently is that a push towards opening up data around brownfield sites. Where can we build new properties so that we can address the housing crisis, for example?
Isn't there a danger, and we heard it at the end of that report, of overclaiming what data can do? So Manchester, for instance, is getting a lot more data. It used to just get it from censuses. It used to be looking in the past, it's now getting current data, but that doesn't give it the resources, for example, to suddenly send a new bus to that crowd of people coming out. It knows they're there, but it doesn't necessarily have the money to you know, buy a new bus or change the timetable.
Yeah, so for me, then when you really unlock the value of data, it's by helping lots of different types of people make better decisions more quickly, and that can be us as citizens, it can be businesses, it can be the public sector, local authority that's doing that kind of planning. The crucial thing is getting that data to as wide a group of people as possible. So the cautionary note that I'd have around this Manchester story is who has control of that data, who has it, who has access to it, what other apps and services and products could be built over the top of it that mean that we can really get the value out of it.
So briefly, it's about ownership of data as well as just having huge amounts of it.
Ownership and access, as important as actually collecting it.
Well, we've run out of time again. Thanks to my special guest, Jenny Tennyson from the Open Data Institute. Thank you to Chris Baraniuk too from the BBC Tech Desk. You can read all of his stories and mine and Dave Lee's at bbc.com/technology. Don't forget to tell all of your friends to download the podcast, which will be available soon. And join us again in the Tech Tent at the same time next week. Before you go, if you're enjoying Tech Tent, then allow me to recommend another offering from the BBC World Service. Just one question first. Do you eat? Well, if you answered yes, then this podcast is for you. The food chain is for farmers, foodies and fellow diners. Go to bbc.com/foodchain to find out more.